Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For most of its 4,000-year history, China has hosted anywhere from a quarter to two-fifths of the world's population. So it should be no surprise that its land is one of the most fragile and abused, yet strangely resilient environments on Earth. Whether it's life-threatening smog over Beijing or one of the countless other million-plus cities in China, cataclysmic floods through deforested ravines, or huge water projects that have displaced people as well as plants and animal species, China remains one of the front lines of ecological degradation. My guest today has written extensively on China's history and environment. Robert B. Marks is a professor of history and environmental studies at Whittier College and the author of numerous books, not only on China's history, but its environment. His latest book is also the title of his lecture as he gives the Cadenhead Suttle Memorial Lecture in History this evening, China, Its History and Environment. The lecture takes place this evening at 6 o'clock at McFarland Library, and it's free and open to the public. And Robert Marks joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Robert Marks, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rich.
Yeah, when it comes to contemporary environmental action on a range of issues, from climate change to air quality to land conservation, China is simultaneously both sort of a bad example and an enabler for other countries to do nothing, especially on climate change.
Yes.
Do you think that's a fair assessment?
I think it's fair up to a point. Things are changing rather dramatically, largely because of the huge environmental challenges that China does face. China has rapidly industrialized over the last 30 years, and that rapid industrialization has come at a cost. Cost to the pollution of land, water, air, quality of life, and people notice. And they've raised serious amounts of noise about quality of life. And the Chinese Communist Party recently said that they're going to start waging now a war on pollution. And just in the recent 2 or 3 months ago, an agreement with President Obama to limit their greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. So there's an opening. There's a moment when things might be changing. But at the moment, it's not a particularly good situation.
What was the galvanizing effect for that? Is this coming from the grassroots up, you think?
Mostly, yeah. If you go to Beijing, China has 10 of the most polluted cities in the world right now, and Beijing is just, the air quality there is pretty horrible. And people there know it, not just simply because of pollution indicators, but because they have to breathe it every day. Other cities as well. And so people are trying to take control.
I was going to say, you know, Beijing is the poster child because, you know, that plane, the smog can get incredibly bad. I think where it could actually kill people at times. People with respiratory diseases already, but are any of the other, 10 or 15 cities or even more that are these huge, huge cities by American standards, are they any better?
No. Some are more advantageously situated on the coast.
Say like Shanghai.
Or Guangzhou, Xiamen. Some of those cities get some coastal breeze that'll kick it out. But you don't get rid of the pollution. It just stacks up someplace else further inland. So it hasn't been solved.
In your book, China, Its Environment and History, you write that the environmental history of China contains several paradoxes. What are some of those paradoxes?
There are several paradoxes, indeed. One is that China has been continuously farming its land for the last 3,000 years. And when you farm land, you take nutrients out. And so even though they've been farming it, and even though there are significant challenges, the Chinese farmers found ways to recycle nutrients back into the soil to maintain its fertility over long, long periods of time. So on the one hand, there is this attention to the quality of land and all of the environmental conditions that make it possible for human beings to survive. That's been part of China's history over the last 3,000 years. At the same time, there has been an almost continuous, relentless drive linking the state over a long period of time to demands for economic development. And that has come, it's not a new call. It's been going on for quite a long time.
And when you say quite a long time, this is well before the People's Republic of China, right?
Yeah, 3,000 years of let's conquer that land and let's turn those forests into farmland.
Yes. One of the things your book does is you actually talk about some of the different approaches, and it says, you know, we have to always remember that all of China's history is written from the Chinese perspective.
Yes.
And that most of the people they supplanted in creating what we now know as China didn't have written records. Perhaps the sole exception would be the Mongols.
Mongols, right.
And the Mongols had a very different concept of how to use the land.
Right. One of the major relationships that is now part of China, but was for a long time not part of China, is the relationship of the land that's farmed and the grasslands to the north. Grasslands get maybe 5, 10, 15 inches of rain, can't support forests, and there's not enough rain for farming. And so a different way of life emerged on the grasslands, focused on herding and moving with your herds. And those peoples were not ethnically Chinese. They are now, we call them Mongols, and are part of the state of Mongolia and Inner Mongolia. But for a very long time, those peoples moved with their herds, came into contact with Chinese at various times. And the person who pulled all of those together into a unified force in the 13th century was Genghis Khan, who had a small vision, and that was to conquer the world, and almost succeeded.
Right.
But they have a conception of the relationship of human beings to the environment that is conditioned by their experience on the grassland. And to them, farming is not necessarily a natural way of relating to the land. And so they have a different way of looking at it. To them, the desert is not ugly. It's part of the natural landscape and needs to be incorporated into your understandings of how people should, in fact, relate to the land.
And I think that's one of the things that you point out is that China is a whole host of different sub-ethnic groups that are moving into these areas, and they really don't know how to relate to the land they're moving into for the longest time. Just as in Americans, when we headed west, what did we do? We plowed up the prairies, the short grass prairies, and were surprised when they didn't stick around.
Well, the people who we call Chinese, the ethnic Chinese, that came into being over a long period of time. But these people originated on the North China Plain. And the place that we now call China is a huge place. It's about geographically the same size as the United States. And it was not an area or a place that was devoid of other people, just like it wasn't devoid of other animals or other forests. But when Chinese and the North China Plain began expanding toward the south, they encountered peoples who were not ethnically Chinese. There's hundreds of different peoples. And basically, the farming and the state that the Chinese had gave them greater power. And they could, in fact, take land, transform forests into farms, and the people who were there had a choice. Well, they actually had three choices. They could assimilate, they could stay on the margins, or they could fight. And at times, all those choices were made. But over time, mostly the peoples who were in environments that the Chinese were moving into either assimilated or fled. And there was a considerable amount of warfare as well. And to that extent, Rich, yes, it's a similar situation to Europeans moving across North America, encountering people who had different ways of relating to the land. Transforming it into farms does, in some cases, it'll work for quite some time. In other cases, it will result in environmental degradation of various sizes.
Well, I think you put your finger on it when you say, you know, we forget that China's about the same size as the United States. You wouldn't farm the same way in New England as you would in the desert southwest or the Pacific Northwest or the southeast. I mean, there's vastly different ways of doing things. And it seems like China sort of had a monoculture of how it used the land.
It's based on the family farm.
Yeah, right.
supported by the state. And the state wanted family farms as a basis for tax-paying units. Now, the farmers on the North China Plain relied on dry field crops, rain-fed crops, wheat, millet, those kinds of things. But when Chinese moved into the more watery south, they did adapt. They adapted and began to farm rice that local peoples had done. But that still is in the confines of the family farm. So there's some adaptation on the Chinese part in terms of adapting to the environments, but the institutional format, that is the relationship of a family farm to a state, remained pretty much the same.
Now, here's another paradox that you mentioned in the book, is that biologists estimate about 40% of the mammal species in China are endangered.
Right.
Upwards of 70% of the plant species are threatened, yet China still has this incredible biodiversity. It's one of the most biodiverse areas outside of the Amazon. That's sort of a hard thing to get your head around.
It's another huge paradox. The biodiversity that exists in China is squeezed into a small part of the southwest corner of China in a province called Yunnan. And I'll talk a little bit about that tonight. It's an interesting story. But this is a part of the world that China and Chinese farms moved into in the 18th century. But a number of factors, including malaria, kept Chinese and Chinese farms out of the malarial regions for quite some time. And so there's been a preservation of large numbers of Chinese, we call now national minorities, different ethnicities, and their ways of relating to the land. And because it's an area of vast mountains and plains and river valleys, there's a huge number of ecosystems that have been created for various plants and animals to exploit. So that is the region where it's not just China's diversity, natural diversity exists, but about a quarter of the world's plant species exists there, and 15 to 20% of the animals as well. And there's a huge struggle right now over whether or not that should be part of China's economic development and transformed, or whether or not it should be preserved.
And in transforming, we're probably, what, talking hydroelectric projects?
Hydroelectric projects. There's one river in this region that hasn't been dammed yet. It's called the Nujiang, or translated as the Angry River. And 10 years or so ago, the Chinese state proposed that a cascade of 13 dams be built on this river, which caused a certain amount of reaction by not just simply environmental NGOs around the world and in China, but among the people there as well. So there was a considerable amount of public opposition, and so the state backed away for a while, but it looks like planning is going ahead to put dams, maybe five dams, on this river for the creation of electricity.
Really, local opposition has never had too much of effect on the Chinese Communist government when you think of what's happened up north, the Three Gorges and all that. I mean, there was plenty of opposition, but the government just sort of went ahead.
Anyway. And what got the attention of the locals who were living along the Nujiang, along the New River, was learning what had happened to people like them on a river not too far away called the Lansang, which people also know as the Mekong, which drains into Vietnam. But there was a very large dam built there, and the people who were living along the river were relocated and promised that they would be given land, housing, et cetera, et cetera. But when people from the New River went to the Lansang, they found that they had been relocated, but their conditions of life dramatically deteriorated. Same thing happened with the people relocated to make the Three Gorges Dam. It looks like that opposition has been overcome, and the state is going to go ahead and approve the building of those dams.
My guest today is Robert Marks. He's a professor of history and environmental studies at Whittier College. He's the author of numerous books on China's history and environment. He'll be giving the Cadenhead Settle Memorial Lecture this evening at 6 o'clock in McFarland Library on the University of Tulsa. On his latest book is sort of the title of the talk, China, Its Environment and History. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Earlier, we were talking about this little slivers of biodiversity, and it's really on the edges of China where they just basically, for whatever reason, haven't gotten to that area yet. I think in one of its apex species is a really interesting example of how this huge population, anywhere from a quarter to 40% of the world's population at any given time, when you look at a species like the tiger, and we know that the tiger is threatened and endangered all over its range. But it was, of course, at one point roamed all over China. And now where you look at the current range of the tiger, it's north of China, it's west of China, it's south of China, but not in China.
Not in China.
Yeah.
No, the tiger has been extirpated basically from China. There might be some Siberian tigers up along the Russian and Korean border. But they don't exist within the borders of China. And if you look at maps of the south and the southwest, tigers do exist in Myanmar, Burma, Laos, Vietnam. It's basically the same environment. And the difference is that those parts of the world haven't removed their forests. Tigers like forests, and they've been removed on the Chinese side of the border to make way for farms, and that has simply destroyed the environment for the tiger.
Is there a bigger story beyond the tiger that sort of explains where you can see this graph and you can basically see the outlines of China's borders?
Right. Well, it's the expansion of farming over the last 3,000 years, which removed forest, and it was largely connected up with the strategic interests of the Chinese state. And they pushed the farming, economic development as far as they could to borders that they could control, and that led to the extirpation of the tiger. Now, I should say that a similar thing has almost happened to the elephant and to several other species, but over the last 15 years, China has created over 2,000 nature preserves. Some of those have some reality to them, and some of them are just lines drawn on a map. But in the far southwest, there, about 30 years ago, there was maybe 100 Asian elephants left within China. But there's been a considerable amount of protection of those elephants, and that elephant population is now up to about 300. Similar stories are emerging in a few other places in Boyang Lake. Along the Yangtze, there's a very large stork and egret population that's beginning to grow. So there are some indicators that Chinese are learning how to live with other species as well. For the tiger, it's probably too late.
I think one of the things you write is, you know, we have to remember that China began reaching its ecological limits. I think that you have a 500-year range or something, anywhere from 1300 to 1800, definitely by 1800. Yeah, that they had reached their, and also you have to remember, with this huge long period, thousands of years of civilization, when you look at other places around the world where there's been continuous civilizations, the environments are pretty ravaged.
Yes.
Is that just a factor of man?
It's a combination of humans, the way we organize ourselves institutionally, economically, politically. But China is one place on the planet that has had more or less 3,000 years of more or less continuous development. Other places have had great discontinuities, which have allowed forests and nature to recover. The fall of the Roman Empire in Europe allowed forests to recover because the population declined dramatically. In the Americas, following the discovery of America by Columbus and then the conquest, the population of the Americas dropped from maybe 70 million to perhaps 8 or 9 million by 1600, allowing forests to recover and animals to recover as well. So it's been discontinuous in many other parts of the world, whereas in China, the process has been more continuous than not. So the limits of empire were reached probably early 19th century, which meant then that the Chinese had to continually find ways of exploiting resources that were within their borders as well.
How important is the environment to the current leadership of China? You have anywhere from a quarter to two-fifths of the world's population.
Right.
Is feeding that population paramount over any other consideration like the environment?
Well, feeding the population has been a strategic concern of the Chinese state, and it continues to be. The Chinese state has decided that it will have food security, which means that they will continue to produce food within its own borders. The Chinese state has also had a policy of rapid industrial development. Heavy industry fueled by export industry, light industry, socks. Now Apple has Foxconn factories throughout the place. And the state is beginning to want to transition from export-driven economic growth to consumer-driven economic growth, which means that the 1.3 billion Chinese are being encouraged to consume. And making that transition is not going to lighten the demand on natural resources within China as well. Now, given all of that, the Chinese government, Chinese Communist Party, is beginning to pay some attention. 10 years ago, ecology was included in the elementary school curriculum, for example. As I mentioned earlier, the government has said that they are going to start waging a war on pollution. And the reason is that one of the biggest sellers of any household equipment in Beijing are air purifiers. And the government officials have to, they live in apartments, they're buying air filters as well. And so they know that the environmental underpinnings of the quality of life are being eroded and have been eroded, and it's got to stop. So the question is, are there elements in China's tradition that will allow them to reconnect with it and develop ways of making some progress to turn back the tide of the rolling pollution that's affecting everybody? On the one hand, there's been 3,000 years of continuous development in China. On the other hand, at various times, Chinese have taken a look and said, hey, we've got to be really careful about exploiting the resources that we have because it'll undermine our civilization. Other times, there have been people who have who've said, well, humans and nature are one.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese government is saying that China will have a harmonious relationship with nature. Now, that's going to be a pretty big break with patterns of the past.
You know, when I think of America's own history, and of course to compare the two is apples and oranges, yeah. Very much so. But you know, we had great environmental damage in our country to a lesser degree than China today. But
yes.
but it was a whole series of events in the 1960s, everything from Silent Spring to, you know, DDT wiping out your
right.
national symbol, the bald eagle, or things like the Cuyahoga River catching
yes.
on fire. Right. All of these things together sort of created a catalyst for act. They
yes.
were a catalyst for action. Has China had that moment yet, do you think?
Not quite.
They've had some horrible things happen.
Yes, it's building. Just to give you again, these are paradoxes. On the one hand, let me say first that Whittier College, where I'm from, is in the middle of Los Angeles. And when I came to Los Angeles in 1978, there were 110 what we called first-stage smog alerts. The air was filled with ozone, and it hurt to breathe. But the state of California began mandating emissions controls on vehicles and a number of other steps as well. So today, the air is incredibly better. It's a three-decade process. California is considered by many in China, municipalities, provincial government, and even people in the central government, to be a case study of what can happen. And it will require regulations that are not simply passed, but are then enforced. And it can be done. As I said, it took California about 30 years. Has there been that moment when protecting people's lives and the environment is equal or more important than the 7-9% GDP growth that's built into the plan? We're not quite there yet, I don't think.
Mm. And there's some serious, serious issues confronting China. I mean, one of the things which shows up in a myriad ways is the deforestation that's taking place. That means when any rainfall that deviates from norm often cause cataclysmic mudslides, floods, and what you're seeing, tremendous loss of life.
Right. And that was one moment when it looked like there was going to be some change. 1997-98 was an El Nino year around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us in California remember it very well. But it brought a tremendous amount of rainfall to the upper reaches of the Yangtze River. And because of the deforestation of the upper reaches, that led to massive flooding all the way downstream and huge siltation. And so the central government put a ban on logging old growth forests. And that ban seems to have stuck, is in place. Whether or not there's reforestation attempts that are going to deal with that is another question. But the Chinese state can make decisions rapidly, and in that particular case, it did. But much of China remains subject to the erosion that comes with the deforestation and the ripping up of the grasslands as well.
Yeah, and water control is another issue where every stream that's flowing free, there's sort of a tendency because of the water needs to dam them and to create hydroelectric power.
Not just hydroelectric power. Well, the power to fuel the industrial growth is essential, but so is controlling water and storing it for irrigation. So China, since 1950, has built 84,000 dams.
84,000
dams. It's a
How does that compare to the United States? Because I know we have a lot of dams too, but but nowhere near, I wouldn't think we have as many as 84,000.
Well, there are many interesting comparisons between China and the U.S. We have both have about the same number of ecosystems, take up about the same amount of space. Population density and numbers are another story. But the U.S. has and has had about 80,000 dams as well. And this means anything from small weirs to
Hoover Dam.
Hoover Dam.
Yeah.
And China has those as well, although something on the order of 26,000 of China's dams are large hydroelectric projects. But China, North China is especially, it's been dry. It's has a serious water crisis. Pumping of water out of aquifers has lowered the land, the level. The Yellow River stopped getting to the Yellow Sea about 15 years ago on an intermittent basis, and now it dries up about 500 kilometers from the ocean. And so China is embarking on one of the largest water management schemes in the world. And they've got a 3,000-year history of massive water control projects. But this is known as the South to North Water Transfer Project, to take water from the Yangtze Basin and move it north using three routes, one the old Grand Canal route, another one going through central China, and one closer to the headwaters of the Yangtze River and the Yellow River. But these are projects that will be moving water 1,000, 1,500 miles from where it seems to be in greater abundance. That's a question of whether it is or not, to the parched northern parts of China.
Very quickly, you've talked about how China has sort of turned a page in sort of tackling climate change and CO2 emissions. Do you really think that they can get a handle on that over the next 15 years?
Yes, and I think they're going to have to. Because it's a large issue that involves negotiations with the United States, but it's the quality of life of people living in China, and the leaders know that they have to address it.
All right. Robert Marks, thanks very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure, Rich.
Robert B. Marks is a professor of history and environmental studies at Whittier College and will be giving the Caden Head Settle Memorial Lecture in History this evening. His latest book is titled China, Its History and Environment. That, incidentally, will be the title of the lecture, which takes place this evening at 6 o'clock at McFarland Library on the University of Tulsa campus. The lecture is free and open to the public. Information at 918-631-2338. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.